I would like to welcome Jean Hillebald. Please, if you will, come forward. And while you're coming up, I will begin our introduction. Jean is the daughter of Art and Jane Hillebald, who were members of this fellowship for many years, and some of you will remember them. Jean has been an instructor in the English department at the University of Regina since 1990, and her main research interests are in writings by women, particularly lesbians and African Americans. Jean writes herself in several genres, often lesbian fiction and erotica, and she's legally married to the woman she has spent 25 years with, so there must be an anniversary around this time somewhere. You know, last year, Halloween, okay. Together, they have raised 3 children from previous marriages, and I read somewhere that Jean gives credit to serendipity for her surprisingly stable and middle-class life. I bet there's a little education and maybe some income thrown in there, too. You know. So welcome, Jean. We are looking forward to your talking with us this morning about progress that has been made over the last 50 years.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here in my parents' old stomping ground. As some of you know, they passed away in 2009. So I will try to sprint through 50 years of progress. And the progress made by what used to be called the gay community is stranger than fiction. I'll just ask, how many of you know what the Stonewall Riots were? If you raise your hand. Okay, some do. Okay, this was an event that was unprecedented and unexpected. It took place in a disreputable bar in Greenwich Village in 1969, and Judy Garland had died the day before. Some people say this is not a coincidence, because a lot of gay men just revered her, and they were grieving. The police came to make one of their usual raids. The police in those days had a quota of the number of deviants they would haul out of certain bars. And of course, there was no such thing as an openly gay and lesbian center in those days. There were bars that had a rumors associated with them, because queer people could hang out there, deviants as they were called, perverts. And there was all kinds of coded language. I mean, there was a whole culture of the closet. Men who tried to pick each other up could be arrested for soliciting, much like prostitutes. So the code word was, have you got a match? Man would ask another man, have you got a match? And that meant something, if you knew the code. And of course, the police were always running to catch up with the code so they could arrest people. So the police arrived, as usual, on June 28th. It was a hot night. And the regulars fought back. And this was unheard of. There was a riot. The police had to send for reinforcements because there weren't enough of them to fight the ragtag regulars, including drag queens who would come out in full drag. And according to the legends that gathered after that, some of these drag queens had like platform heels, and they used them to whack New York's finest. And so the next night, the police showed up with riot gear. The next night, the regulars told all their friends, and they showed up in drag, and they fought. And, I mean, it was an amazing event, because, of course, the bar regulars were unarmed. The police were armed. But, I mean, the bar regulars were refusing to go to jail. And immediately, in the week after that, there was all kinds of organization. At least 2 different gay rights organizations were founded that same week. And the movement spread. So then there was a perception of a community of people who had been denied justice and denied their rights. This was a total transformation of identity, really, because before that, there wasn't really an organized community. There were people that their parents and their relatives were ashamed of. There were people who were sent to mental hospitals. There were people who had secret lives. that they were often ashamed of and didn't want to tell anybody. So the gay rights movement sort of started from there, and I mean, it progressed actually with great speed, some setbacks, but actually with great speed since then. And of course, Saskatchewan has its own history, which is somewhat separate from the history of gay rights in other places. When I first came out by going to the local gay club, as it was called, in the early 1980s, nobody celebrated Pride Week here. That was a New York thing. Like, it was celebrated in big cities in the U.S., and I think they might have started celebrating it in Toronto. But we had local traditions here. We had Halloween, and that was kind of an unofficial queer holiday because anybody could wear whatever they wanted. And so I found that both in Regina and Saskatoon, hordes of people would come out for Halloween. And then from 1978 to 1989, there was a well-organized festival, four-day festival called Metamorphosis during the Thanksgiving Day weekend, always held in Saskatoon. And of course, the title came from the idea of springing out of your cocoon. You know, if you're in the closet, you're kind of like a little worm in your cocoon. And then when you come out, you spread your wings. And that was the purpose of Metamorphosis. We could all spread our wings. It was marvelous. And there were even activities for the children of queer parents. My daughter looked forward as much as I did to going there every year. Unfortunately, it sort of fell apart after 1989, and there was talk about reviving it, and it never revived. And somebody told me it's because you need a few good organizers to organize an event, and some of the key people moved away. So, but I think another thing that was happening in Saskatchewan is that, like, basically this formerly closeted community was becoming more aware of national and international ties. We were becoming more connected with communities and organizations in other places. We were aware that Pride Week had become a big thing in places like San Francisco. And, I mean, in fact, in the planning meetings for Metamorphosis, there was this kind of ritual question. An organizer would always ask, should we march in the streets? You know, they march in the streets for Pride Week and other places. And somebody would always say, not on your life. I have a job that I don't want to lose. You know, I have custody of my kids, luckily. I don't want to lose those. You know, I don't want everyone I know to stop speaking to me. And then someone else would say, well, I would march, but how pitiful would it be to have a parade of six people who can afford to be out in public? So we'd always decide not to march. A number of things changed after that. The history of the organized gay community in Saskatchewan dates from 1972. Of course, it wasn't that long after the Stonewall riots. Both in Regina and Saskatoon, organizations were formed to basically set up places to hang out. And in Regina, that place became known as the Smith Street House. Somebody owned a house, and they just kind of threw open their doors every weekend to other members of the community, and it was bring your own bottle. And that was the beginning of a gay bar in Regina. In 1973, homosexuality was removed from the standard diagnostic manual used by psychiatrists, and that was a big change. That was progress. Because after that, it was harder for anybody to push anyone into a psychiatric hospital, or basically tell them they had to be cured to be sane. In 1982, of course, we got the Charter of Equality Rights. And this is something they didn't get in the U.S. You might be aware that in the U.S., there was endless discussion of the Equal Rights Amendment that would have given women equal rights with men. But it had to be ratified state by state. The deal was that within a limited period of time, I think two-thirds of the 50 states in the U.S. had to ratify this, and it didn't work. It did. They weren't able, like, women went door to door canvassing for this, and it didn't succeed. So to this day, officially, American women don't have equal rights with men under the law, but Canadian women do since the 1980s. And I think that's the legal basis of same-sex marriage. I mean, it's a thing of wonder to queer people in other countries and in the U.S. because they've had same-sex marriage state by state. That's how it usually works. And I've had phone calls from people who ask, where in Canada could we go and get married? And I say, wherever you want, from coast to coast. And they're amazed that it was a national thing. And I think it's because with the Charter of Equality Rights, marriage became officially a union of equals. Of course, a husband and wife can relate any way they want, but under the law, it's a union of equals. And therefore, no one could say anymore, well, you couldn't have two men or two women getting married, because who would be the husband and who would be the wife? Doesn't matter anymore. And of course, after the Charter of Equality Rights was passed, there was a lot of confusion about what rights people had if they were either gender nonconforming or their sexual orientation was considered unusual. Some people said that everybody had equality under the Charter. And some said, well, no, because it needs to be made explicit that sexual orientation and or gender identity have to be prohibited grounds of discrimination. So that started proceeding province by province. And in 1993, we got, basically, I think gender identity is still under debate legally. But I was part of a little organization that pressed for sexual orientation as a prohibited grounds. And we got it in 1993. And I think part of the reason it didn't create a big uproar among the right wing is because it was combined with several other prohibited grounds. So from that date, you couldn't discriminate against anybody on grounds of their marital status or whether they were receiving social assistance as well as sexual orientation. So it passed with no controversy. So we've had that ever since. Another thing that was happening in that time that I think most people were not aware of is that same-sex couples, especially those who were fairly long-term, who'd been living together for at least a year, started being treated like married couples when it benefited any level of government. But we didn't have the advantages of being married. And I think this was part of the push for same-sex marriage. I mean, same-sex marriage was really controversial within the community that is now known as GLBT, gay, lesbian, bi, trans. Because some people said it would assimilate us too much, it would make us bourgeois, we would lose our colorful roots, you know, in a very unusual and closeted community. And basically it would create more class divisions, basically, within the GLBT community, and I think it has. But some of us were outraged that the government was now saying you have to pay tax as though you were married, but you don't get any of the advantages. Like Mirta and I, before we were legally married, we had a long fight with Revenue Canada about this. We were filing income tax as two single parents. So we each claimed the equivalent to married deduction for one child, which a single parent can do. Married parents can't do that. So they saw we were claiming, between us, we were claiming a lot of deductions. And we got a stiff letter saying, we've noticed you're filing from the same household. Note that household is not a legal term. And therefore, we're taking away all your deductions except your basic personal. Can't claim anything. So, of course, we argued, and this continued for years. We heard of cases of people denied welfare, people who had no income, because it was discovered that they were living with someone who had an income. So actually, when we had the right to marry, it did improve things. It gave us a more coherent and consistent kind of status with every level of government. And of course, you know, as I've said, I mean, it blows me away that I have middle class status, that I can basically be out of a closet, that I'm not considered a freak, a pervert, any of those things. But there are still members of our community, loosely speaking, who are still considered freaks and who don't have full rights. I think the next fight that is still being fought is for transgendered people, people who are considered gender dysphoric, or, you know, whose gender identity doesn't match their biological sex, however their relatives want to define them. They're not always accepted, even in social space that's designated for GLBT people. And of course, I mean, there has been an ongoing, how shall I put it, not a war exactly, but more like rivalry between brothers and sisters, between gay men and lesbians. We don't always get along. We don't always have the same interests. And of course, in the last few years, there have been some organizations of bisexuals who say that they aren't recognized as bisexual. When they're in a relationship with someone of the other gender, they're considered, quote, normal. When they're in a relationship with someone of their own gender, they're asked, when will you come all the way out of the closet by declaring that you will never again have sex with somebody who doesn't have the same plumbing that you have. That's a fight that's ongoing as well. The thing that's amazing, I think, about the amount of success and acceptance we've had is partly based on the fact that we're a really diverse community. And people keep adding letters to the alphabet soup. GLBT is now the basic. But then some people say, well, there's something called genderfuck. I'm not sure I totally understand what that is, but there are those who identify as genderfuck, as distinct from being trans. There are transvestites who are distinct from transgender. Those are people who like to wear what they consider the clothing of the other sex. And notice that clothing styles for women have changed so much, definitely in the last 50 years, that I don't know how you could be a female transvestite, because it's acceptable for us to dress like this, regardless. So there has been progress, but there is still progress yet to be made. And I'm just, I'm grateful for how far we've come so far. And I think Canadians in particular can be proud of our laws and traditions and how they have furthered this progress. A culture is always a work in progress. And I'd say the status of GLBT people is like that. It's the definition of the community itself is always changing. The way people perceive it or aspects of it is always changing. And so, I wish I could live at least another 50 years, if not 100, to see how things will develop in the future. Thank you. And I'll take questions if anyone wants to ask.
Not the riot itself, but the outcome. The groups spun off from it. Were there people who were in prison? Did this continue to happen night after night, or what was the story there?
Well, the general trend before the Stonewall riots was for the police to play a cat and mouse game. They would just round up everybody from a disreputable bar on the assumption that everybody was a pervert. They'd throw them in jail overnight and let them out. And, I mean, this was why, at that time, middle-class people who identified as queer and who had jobs that they didn't want to lose, generally didn't go to the bars. They had house parties. The gay culture, as it was called then, was basically a friendship network. People, you'd have to know somebody who knew somebody, and that's how they stayed out of jail. So, police raids continued to happen, but the thing that was new after the riots was that now there was an organized opposition. And it wasn't really organized before then. I mean, obviously, people resent being hauled into jail, especially if it happens over and over, and especially if they're abused in all kinds of ways by the police, in ways that they can't, can't protect themselves and can't redress in any court. So that kind of thing did continue to happen. But now there were organizations, there were spokespeople who said this needs to stop. Then it was looking bad for the police when they continued to do this. Before that, I think the assumption was that the police were there to clean up the streets and that it was their duty to try to shut down queer bars. And most of them were run by the mafia. So the Stonewall Inn was run by the mafia. So in fact, it was associated with organized crime. So basically, everything that wasn't legal was associated with these places.
Jean, we'll just take one more question, okay?
Okay. Sorry.
This isn't actually a question. I'm just putting out here what we all know already, and that is that for all the romantic ideas of marriage, marriage is a legal state that gives you certain privileges and so forth. So the right to be married is the right to be able to benefit from what society, what the law offers.
Yes. And, I mean, there have been tragic cases in the past when there was no same-sex marriage of people who lived together for like 50 years or, you know, as long as any heterosexual marriage, but they had no rights. And often they'd discover that at the end of the marriage or at the end of someone's life. One person, one partner would be in critical condition in the hospital, and that person's family would prevent the partner from seeing the ill person. And of course, a death would create more problems because often then the survivor could not inherit anything. The relatives would swoop in like a plague of locusts and sometimes they would give the surviving partner some little token. But if they had property together and if it wasn't in both names, then the survivor really didn't have many rights.
Jean, thank you so very much for joining us today and for that interesting historical overview. It was really useful. Thanks so much.